Could you get a refund on your car tab fees? A class action lawsuit seeks to accomplish just that by challenging the way Sound Transit passed them. And Car Radio's Hannah Scott has been looking into this. Hannah?
So a complaint was filed in Pierce County Court yesterday ahead of a class action lawsuit on behalf of more than a half dozen local drivers from King Pierce in Snohomish County. Lawyers for the group claim the outdated vehicle valuation system Sound Transit uses to calculate car tab fees under SD3 are unconstitutional and have led to massive overcharges. Some Republican lawmakers have said the same thing, that they were surprised the agency was using that older inflated value method to calculate the tax, since a new, more accurate valuation system was approved in 2006. Now, while that is true, the older valuation system is still in use because Sound Transit had sold bonds based on that tax rate. So the law allows the agency to continue using that older formula until those bonds are paid off, which is in 2028. The claim in the suit that ST3 is unconstitutional centers on the 2015 law that was passed by the legislature on the ST3 proposal and that gave Sound Transit the authority to send it to voters. Joel Ard is one of the lawyers behind the lawsuit, and he tells KTTH's Todd Herman, while that bill did specify that the older inflated valuation system would be used under ST3, it did so with an incomplete and vague reference to the older law, and Ard says you just can't do that.
If you're going to amend a statute, you have to say what you're changing. You have to point to the existing statute and what it says and how it's going to be different in the future. That wasn't done in the legislation that enabled the Sound Transit 3 bond issue.
Okay, so does anybody think they have a good chance of winning this?
Well,
this is a pretty deep technicality, it seems to me.
And it's a constitutional challenge. So the Republican lawmakers who have been trying to get this and arguing this same thing for some time, they tell me they think it can get through. I know one of the big things is at like Senator O'Bann and some others said that they didn't know when they voted for this package to send it to the voters. They didn't realize, they claim, that this was going to be using the old car valuation system. And Democrats, on the other hand, and many other lawmakers say that they do. Even some Republicans say that they do. So it depends. And I haven't talked to anyone impartial to see. I know Sound Transit says that they don't believe it has a chance. They say that it was debated heavily in the legislature and believe everybody knew. So that's been the ongoing argument throughout this.
Okay, so if they do win, this just changes the valuation to a fairer system.
But
it wouldn't actually remove the whole car tab tax, right?
I don't know. It's unclear to me whether they would have to start over. Because what they're saying is that the way that the legislature passed that initial bill that sent ST3, allowed Sound Transit to send this to voters, had that vague reference to the older valuation system in it.
Right.
So I don't know if it would undo everything and they'd have to start fresh. What it asked for specifically in the complaint is $240 million in refunds of car tab fees that have been paid under the system already, and to prevent any new ones. So it doesn't mention anything about undoing the law, but it seems to me that that would have to have some sort of impact. You'd have to change the law.
I mean, the last time there was a lawsuit that was challenging the revenue source of Sound Transit bonds, it was kicked out because once you've signed a bond, is a contract. And if you bond against a certain revenue source, I believe it is illegal for whatever reason to break that, because then you're stealing people's money.
Yeah, there's
money.
A name for that, but that's why they allow Sound Transit to continue to use that older system until 2028, because of that very reason. They have to be allowed to pay back those bonds that they sold based on those original taxes they expected.
Now, I know that Sound Transit got criticized for this and that they were accused of being tone deaf, which is probably true because everybody knows how much people hate those car tabs. Is there any indication that Sound Transit might itself voluntarily go to this fairer...
No.
Valuation system. No way.
No. Sound Transit is adamant, has been throughout all the criticism, all the bills that have failed in the legislature to try to get any form of relief, whether small or large, that any change to the car tab tax in the bill that was passed, in the initiative that was passed, will end up cutting projects that were included in ST3, and that it's just not going to work that way.
They're also concerned about the level of federal funding they're going to get right under the Trump administration. Are there any updates on that? Do we know whether they're going to get the full amount they were expecting?
Last we did a story on that about 10 days ago, that it looks like that they're positive. It's moving in a positive direction. Mm-hmm. They will be able to get some of the federal money that they were anticipating for the Linwood extension.
Right.
So it was moving in the right direction.
So is that the one that's on the chopping block then?
Well, they could lose up to more than $1 billion worth of that if the FTA. Remember, we talked about and asked them for more information to go back and make sure all the I's were crossed and everything. But then again, that would still be up to a presidential budget. that, you know, you could slash or whatever. But it, right now, the latest news on Linwood is that it's moving in a positive direction. They think they're going to get that money.
Okay. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
A Wednesday morning, the scratchy record, it can only be one thing. Felix Bonnell has emerged from the vault deep beneath the Bonneville Broadcast Center. If you've taken the Seattle Underground Tour or you've ridden a local duck boat, you know something about the Great Seattle Fire, which started 129 years ago today. But there were two other fires that summer that you feel we should be aware of. Felix, by the way, is brought to us by the King County Library System. And one of them, I'm guessing, based on the book you just handed me, called Spokane Saga, happened in Spokane.
Yeah, the only of the three fires we'll talk about, two have inspired a romance novel, kind of a pulpy novel from the 1950s, as you can tell by the cover there.
But, Spokane Saga, the rebuilding of a city destroyed by Zola Ross.
Sort of a pot boiler there, kind of the heaving bosom kind of fire. So there's not one about Seattle, unfortunately, but that fires in those days were almost a form of urban renewal. Those pioneer cities of the 1850s and 1860s were wiped out, allowing a fresh start for a more modern metropolis. So, you know, the cities in those days were mostly wood, right? And the wood had been curing for many years. It was like stacked like cordwood. Seattle's fire began with a boiling pot of glue on a stove and a carpenter's efforts to try to put the fire out, which was a bad idea to dump water on it, spread to the sawdust. Now, you know that big colorful mural of the fire at Mohai?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was dedicated back in 1953 at the old Mohai in Montlake. And on that occasion, somebody had the bright idea to assemble a panel of eyewitnesses to the 1889 fire, which at that point was only 64 years in the past, which would be like 1954, which doesn't seem that long ago to me.
No.
Anyway, radio station KXA, which is actually our sister station KTTH, was there that day, and they were smart enough to record the memories for posterity. I stumbled across those recordings back in 2000 in the archives at Mohai. There's cuts of Charles Thorndike. He was 83 or 84 when he shared his memories of the fire. He was 20 years old on June 6, 1889, and on the job just north of Madison Street.
I was working in a hardware store operated by P. Haynes at 1007 Front Street, which was a block and three or four doors north of where the fire started. We didn't think the fire was going north. We felt for an hour after its start that it was headed south and would not come our way, but soon we found the smoke coming up through the boards and planks which were covered the piles and on which the store building was built. The smoke and the flames began to come up, and then we took the movable stores out of the building and carried them across the street at the corner of the northeast corner of First and Madison Street.
Yeah, and I love hearing that scratchy old recording. That's just sets my day off right. Spring of 1889 was one of those warm, dry seasons we seem to get every decade or so, where May is hot and dry. Not like this year. We've had one of these maybe 5 or 6 years ago. You get that high pressure winds from the north all the time. That's why the fire mostly burned south of First and Madison where it started, but it also creeped north as well, as far north as University in some parts, and mostly bounded by 2nd and 3rd Avenue. Fire department was all volunteer in those days. The chief was out of town on June 6th. He was the best qualified guy to organize a response, and the tide was out, so there's little or no access to water. Now, it was less than a month later, on July 4th, when Ellensburg caught fire. The cause of that blaze has never been satisfactorily determined, but the place it started was a grocery store on Main between 4th and 5th, if you know downtown Ellensburg at all. It was late at night. There's plenty of conspiracy theories about that fire. They've never figured out the cause, and apparently there's lots of information about who might have done it or what the reason was. It took 4 hours to burn and 4 months for the city to rebuild itself. And we have great pictures of this fire, all these fires at My Northwest, of course. It was 1 month after that, on Sunday, August 4th, when Spokane Falls caught fire in the late afternoon. And one person actually died in that fire. These other fires didn't, there were no fatalities. And that blaze in Spokane was accidental. It started in a small hotel and a restaurant on Railroad Avenue. There was a lot of shifting winds, and they blew up buildings to try to create a fire break. Mm-hmm. It was just chaotic. And all the fire departments were volunteer in those days. About 30 blocks of Spokane burned, and a tent city went up in its place. Now, this is my favorite part about the Spokane fire. All these provisions rolled into town from all over the place to sort of help the poor people of Spokane, including a lot of cured meats that apparently several members of the city government ended up stocking in their basements. And they started to call the city leaders the Ham Council, because everybody just took advantage of all these free provisions that came into town. Fortunately, they shortened the name of Spokane Falls to Spokane in 1890, not as a result of the fire, but just probably to save time. Let's get back to Charles Thorndike. He survived the fire, of course. He went back to the remains of the hardware store on June 7th.
I had just completed a few weeks of service in that store and had money enough to buy a new suit of clothes, and I was very proud of it. But in taking the material out of the store, I took off the coat and vest and put it in a desk and moved the desk across the street with the rest of the stuff. The next morning, the desk was gone, and I never got the suit of clothes back.
So I think the factors in all three fires were the fact the wood was all cured, we had that dry weather, water pressure was tough to come by in the 1880s, and all volunteer firefighter forces. Do we have time to play this last cut?
Yeah,
we do. Let's hear this last little bit. This is an unidentified woman speaking about the Great Seattle Fire.
Well, Professor Ingraham kept all the children in school, and then we were everyone cautioned to go straight home. And I went straight to the fire and stayed until a policeman found me.
Anyway.
Wow. Always seeking adventure, apparently.
Yeah, little kids always love fires.
Wow. Now, does Mohai still have that exhibit, that Seattle Fire exhibit there?
They actually had to create a smaller version of that mural for the new museum. The original mural's in storage, but they do have an exhibit dedicated to the fire because it's a seminal event of the city's history and kind of clearing away the old pioneer city and letting us build a modern metropolis.
Right. Felix Bunnell, he joins us each Wednesday, and all his features are at MyNorthwest.com.
And it's time for your daily dose of kindness. Students at Hoover High School in San Diego love their lunch lady. Deborah Davis is her name. She's been in food service for years and goes out of her way to form relationships with the kids.
I feed the kids. I prepare the food. I talk to them. I stop them from fighting. They don't cuss. You know, they have to respect. And they call me Aunt Debbie.
Well, it's not just the kids that understand the value of someone like Aunt Debbie, the school's principal, well aware of the pivotal role she plays.
Debbie comes to campus every single day. With a smile on her face, ready to take on the day and serve our students. So to see this gift that so many people have been a part of in making it happen is a wonderful thing.
And what do you do for someone like Aunt Debbie, as he alluded to? They figured something out. To reward her, the students hatched a plan to get her a new car. She'd been driving an old beat-up 76 Chevy Malibu, so it was time for an upgrade. They found a previously owned car that they could afford, and then the kids in the auto shop program repaired the dings and dents, and then they looked on as the brand new car rolled out to surprise her.
Thank y'all so much. Thank y'all so much. I'm looking for my reward in heaven, and y'all gave me a little bit here on earth.
It's completely out of the blue to thank their favorite lunch lady.
And the fact that the shop kids worked on it, that's great.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Danny, I'm not used to this feeling. You could literally, I mean, anybody listening could literally call up their friends in any city in America, except maybe Boston and New York, and send out a text bragging about their baseball team. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's exactly right. Better get used to it. It's the new world order.
Is it?
We came and saw Houston. Houston's got a problem. Houston's problem is the Seattle Mariners.
I've never heard that before. Houston, that's really good because you're talking, you're riffing off the astronaut thing, aren't you?
Oh, I feel you're having fun at my expense, Dave. It usually works the other way around. I don't like being on the business end of your humor.
No, I'm sorry about that. Anyway, continue.
It's pretty exciting. I mean, really, like you look at that game last night, they jumped out on top. They scored four runs in the first inning, three different home runs that they hit. And yeah, you can walk around with your chest puffed out a little bit, Dave.
Oh, that's good. Do you think we should handle it that way? I just feel like the fragility of being a Mariners fan. You know, it's a dangerous waters to tread in right now. Do we boast? Do we brag? Do we walk around with our chest puffed out? Or do we step into this carefully and see what happens for the rest of the season?
You've got to find what's comfortable for you, Colleen. Do you feel that you're a good winner? Like, do you feel that, like, because I think that I'm a pretty miserable winner. Like, I like, especially when the team first gets good, having some expense at the opponent's, some fun at the opponent's expense.
I just don't want to be hurt again, Danny. That's all I'm saying.
I say give in to your braggadociosity, Colleen. Just go for it.
All right.
Yeah, I would say this, like, to channel a little bit of Goodwill Hunting, like when Matt Damon turns
like
to
them
Robin
apples?
Williams' character. Oh, yeah, I was thinking more along the lines of, like, that sounds like a really great philosophy. If you never get really excited about a sports team again, then you'll never really truly get disappointed again.
Yeah.
Like, no, of course you should get excited. This is a third of the way through the season. They just went and beat the defending World Series champions. They're two games in front. You know they're going to leave Houston in first place in the division. That's great.
Cool.
So have the Mariners ever, how does this stack up compared to past Mariners seasons in terms of their one loss record?
Well, this is the best right now that they've been at this point in the year, I believe, since 2001.
Wow.
2002, they were also a pretty successful team. But it's really, I mean, you're looking at the last time they made the playoffs. And if they play 500 baseball the rest of the way, this is a playoff team.
Wow.
Like they've been that good so far that if they just play 500 the rest of the way, I think that they'll be in the playoffs. They'll certainly be in the chase for the playoffs.
2001 was the 116 win season?
That's correct.
Right.
And okay. Then the next year they won over 90 games, and then it went off a cliff.
Yeah.
And
then
our strengths
really,
go ahead, Danny.
And then they've really spent that time kind of wavering between, are they rebuilding, can they add a couple veterans and be good, and trying to find a formula, and it looks like right now they've got a team where a number of players are playing at their peak.
I was going to say, and you think it sounds like our strength is in the bats and our pitching's not doing too bad either. This team is gelling.
The reason they're in first is because of the starting pitching, and the starting pitching has been significantly better than anybody expected. And that's even with Felix Hernandez not being better than everybody expected. Felix has kind of been the one that you're concerned about. Mm-hmm. Their starting pitching has been way better than anybody had a right to expect. Now, the reason to think that they can sustain this level of success is that their bats, there's still room for improvement there. Kyle Seager is going to hit better the rest of the season than he has so far this year. Nelson Cruz is probably going to hit better than he has so far this season. And eventually, when Robinson Cano comes back, that's going to be a significant addition as well. There's room for them to improve on the offensive end. I don't think you can expect their pitching to get any better. You're hoping that it holds on as long as it can.
And condolences to the Husky softball team. They came to the end of their season. But do you think they'll be as good next year?
They're a really, really good program, and they have a lot to be really proud of what they put together, what they did. There was a lull in the middle of the season, and the way they came back and what they did against Oklahoma is remarkable. Sometimes you'll see that. A team upends. It's happened a couple times to teams that have beat UConn in the women's basketball tournament, the NCAA women's basketball tournament, beat them in the semifinals, and then don't have enough left in the finals, and they lost a really tough game in the first of the potential three-game set against Florida State. But they built a program that's going to sustain beyond the matriculation and graduation of some seniors.
Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thanks, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Device update. It seems every week there's more that we don't know about Facebook. Let's bring in CBS News tech analyst Larry Magid. The latest story, Larry, indicates that Facebook was sharing my information with device manufacturers that I don't even use, but my friends do. Can you explain that?
Yeah, this is early on. They were trying to get people to start switching over to use mobile technology, and they had deals with Lenovo and I think Huawei and TCL and a couple of other companies to allow you to essentially get the companies to get information about you and your friends based on your usage of the phone. So it was really kind of a marketing deal that would encourage people to start using the phones to log on to Facebook and provide some data to the manufacturer, similar to what BlackBerry had done. And of course, the concern that the New York Times raised when they broke the story is that these are Chinese companies, and at least Huawei is alleged to have had close relationships with the Chinese government. Mm. So the concern is not only could this data be in the hands of the company, which is bad enough, but it could be in the hands of the Chinese government, which of course is quite concerning.
Okay, what I have a hard time getting a handle on is that might be a problem for people who live in China, because we know China likes to police its own people.
Yeah.
But does it have any impact on people in America?
First of all, I don't think it has a huge impact on this one. I mean, because the kind of information it gets, you know, in terms of usernames and things like that and likes, I doubt very much whether the Chinese are going to figure out a way to take great advantage. Now, I could be wrong here, because we know what the Russians were able to do with information that they were able to hack. But this is different than hacking. And it's also important to point out that these companies are major brands. I mean, I've reviewed tons of Lenovo computers over the years. It's highly respected. Lots of people use these brands. Huawei has gotten a little bit of a bad rap lately, but their Honor phones are quite popular among young people. TCL makes very good television sets. So it's not as if these are obscure companies. These are international brands that are sold in the world market and are popular everywhere, including in the United States.
So why do these devices have, what kind of personal information are we talking about? How would this, in fact, be used to help market these things?
Well, first, I want to broaden out, I'll say, but I think the issue is less about China and more about the fact that Facebook is sharing anything with companies. But it could be anything from user data, names, likes, possibly, in some cases, access to your contact list. That would be the one that would bother me the most if that were happening. You know, how much time you're using the phone, things like this. That could be useful from a marketing standpoint. So I am concerned, and again, I'm concerned about them sharing it with anybody, not just Chinese companies.
The Apple Developers Conference was on Monday, I guess. They made some announcements about the operating system. I was intrigued that they're going to incorporate now these various software apps that at least inform you when you're overusing your phone.
Right. I think of it as parental controls for adults. And in fact, they are actually putting the same controls on the kids' phones that they're putting in the adults' phones. The only difference is that the adults can actually enforce those on kids' phones.
Yeah.
Bottom line is you're going to get notifications if you set them to say, hey, Larry, you've been on Instagram too much today. Take a break. But I could extend my time and go ahead and, you know, abuse it even further. You're also going to get these detailed reports, and I think this is going to be the most useful, where you're going to sit down weekly or monthly or daily and figure out just how often you picked up your phone, what apps you used when you picked it up, how long you used them, things of that nature. And hopefully that's going to shock us all into reality and make us be much more cautious. I'm a little skeptical.
Right. Yeah. I mean, is Apple really sincere about this, or have they been under pressure? Is there serious pressure to do this kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. There's a huge tech backlash going on. I mean, it was very evident when Zuckerberg was testifying before Congress. That 60 Minutes piece that ran, I guess, about a year ago now, where somebody likened smartphones to slot machines because you get on an app and you get this variable reinforcement. There's just this notion, and this notion of tech addiction, even though that's never been certified as a legitimate addiction. I think there's just a lot of pressure on Silicon Valley. And by the way, Google announced very similar controls at its developers conference just last month. So this is an industry-wide trend.
I think it's kind of weird. I mean, does Cadillac try to get you to drive its cars less?
Well, I don't know about that, but I know that the Toyota puts up an announcement telling me to take a coffee break if I've been weaving or driving for
really?
A certain amount of. Yeah, it does. I got that
really?
On my way home from Seattle last week.
I did
take a break, and I did.
On the screen?
It comes up on the screen. It actually shows a picture of a cup of coffee. And fortunately, I was still in the state of Washington where I could get really good coffee, so it worked out well.
Maybe
that was a Starbucks, you know, had infiltrated Toyota. I'm not sure how that works.
So it says, Larry, you're swerving around to...
Well, there's a lane. There's another thing which shows if
caffeine.
You're staying in your lane.
I see.
If you're just moving slightly out of the lane, I guess it registers those.
Does it get a cup of coffee? Does it just then up and drive you to a Starbucks?
Or... No, you actually have to drive yourself. But the GPS tells you how to get there.
Tech consultant Larry Magid. Thank you, Larry.
My pleasure.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Charlie LaDuff is, I think it's fair to say, you jump into a story with both feet. In fact, I saw a TV piece you did where you were trying to find out how long it took the Detroit cops to respond to a robbery call. And you stayed with that woman for so many hours, she finally let you take a bath in her bathtub?
Sure did. Well, you know, the reason she let me take a bath is because when I went back to McDonald's to get a sweet tea with no ice, when I came back, I spilled it on my pants, in which case I took a bubble bath and she laundered my pants. Indeed, it took about 4 hours, and I had to go out to the street to wave down a cruiser. So they're not fast in Detroit, say the least.
Right. Well, I knew there was a perfectly good reason why you took the bath, but I just was using this to illustrate where you come from. You came from blue-collar Detroit, and in 2013, you went out to interview people in the American Outback to see what it was that had... disillusioned them so much. Now it's 5 years later, and I thought it'd be good to ask you for an update. We are, 500 days into the administration of a president who promised to help these folks, and I'm curious if you think that what he's done has satisfied them, if they feel happy with the purchase.
First of all, it's not the Outback, it's the country. Mm-hmm. It's the majority of the country. That's important. Two, I went to live with them, take a bath in their home, work with them, go in the coal mines, you know, sort of anticipating what we all should have known, which is things aren't going well. Here's why I think Trump is the president, the reason people voted for Obama was because regular people feel they got screwed by a corrupt elitist establishment. That's exactly what Obama ran on. Trump simply had to parrot the words. He's not from it. I don't know how he would know it. He might have gleaned it from a construction site or had it polled, but that's exactly how they both won. Do I think things have changed markedly? No. Why do you think 9 million Obama voters went for Trump and 4 million others didn't vote at all? They just feel that the world's moving by, it's moving rapidly, and they're not taken into consideration. And I've been in Washington State many times, and I know many people feel that way, regardless of who's president.
Right. So, all right, whether we pin it on Trump or not, then, what is it that the people that you know best need from their government? Is there anything the government can do for them?
Look, the government makes big decisions that destroy regular people's way of life. You go off to war. You come home, you're walking around on a popsicle stick. You can't get a VA appointment. Your house is worth nothing. It's bounced back. They blew the market full of air. But your brothers are still living in an apartment. More men than ever are not working. Real wages do not go up. You wonder if it can change at all, but you're at least going to stick your eye in the establishment and hope it does get better. Can it get better? I don't think many of us think it can, but that doesn't mean that your frustration's any less or you shouldn't be frustrated, and that, you know, the rise of this guy is not because of a great white menace. It's because of a great discontent.
So you're on the tour for this book show. What do you do next? What's your next big idea?
I'm not sure. Either go back to, you know, media in some way, or I don't know. You know what? Maybe I get into PR or marketing. No, I'm just
I don't know. That sounds like
else that left journalism.
I think that would force you to dress up more than you want to.
How many reporters do you know have like left journalism and they're doing PR? And I'm like, there must be 10 PR people that every reporter left now. There are nobody to PR to.
Well, now that's the big problem is there's like, 10 opinion writers to every reporter now. I think
that's
like
the problem.
There's like a few dozen guys actually going out and reporting the news and the rest of us just talk about it.
Oh, and let's be honest. Like, you got to work. But, you know, you get up in the morning, you sit on the can, you go through your phone or your iPad. What's the news? What's the news? It's usually from 3-5 sources, right? New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, AP, and Reuters. And then there's 80,000 stories from all these websites and stuff. Like, you had nothing to do with it. You just give me your opinion on what they reported. And it's like, how about this one? I'll give you one. Can somebody come back to Flint, please? This was the biggest story in the world for 2 weeks, and it's still screwed up. And nobody's been back.
Is the water still yellow?
Still closing. No, they say the water's okay, but you know, who believes the water's okay? And that's the sort of the context of why you want to get there. It's like the ghost in the machine, the alligator in the pipes. Is it? Isn't it? Should you trust your government? What about what's left? The murder, the lack of work, the poverty. These are the sort of things we might want to busy ourselves with and do them in an interesting way instead of correspondents writing them like a term paper, or they show up in Buster Brown outfits they just got from the Banana Republic. They're nicely starched and a nice brown makeup and their hair's done well. They come in for 1.5 minutes and they're gone. Yeah. That doesn't work.
Show is Charlie Duff's latest book, The Country's Collapsing and the Ratings Are Great, which they are. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it, Charlie.
Really my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And that's just a small part of my conversation with Charlie Duff, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner, by the way. And after the show, we're still putting it together. We have to get all the bleeps in the right spots. And then we'll put it up on the Ross Files podcast.
Great use of sitting on the can. You don't hear that phrase very often anymore.
not nearly enough. I agree.
We'll bring that back.